Acclaimed actor James Gandolfini has died at the age of 51 of an apparent heart attack while on vacation in Italy with his 13-year-old son. Mr. Gandolfini is best known for his iconic portrayal of Tony Soprano in the hit show that shaped a new path for the medium of television, The Sopranos. The role of this unforgettable mob boss demanded every possible color in an actor's palette: menace, humor, violence, tenderness, and soulful inner conflict. Gandolfini picked up 3 Emmys for Best Actor during his 8-year run on the show, and solid placement in television history. His work was no less impressive on the stage and screen. He appeared on Broadway in a critically acclaimed performance alongside Jeff Daniels, Marcia Gay Harden, and Hope Davis in the play God of Carnage. On film, he began his career working with the greats, including Sidney Lumet in Night Falls on Manhattan, Tony Scott in True Romance, John Travolta in Get Shorty, and Robert Redford in The Last Castle. Just this past fall, he could be seen in a role inspired by CIA director Leon Panetta in the Oscar-nominated Zero Dark Thirty. Tonight, we're pleased to pay tribute to this extraordinary actor. We begin with a conversation we taped just hours after Mr. Gandolfini's death with one of the most successful directors of the Sopranos series, Alan Coulter. Mr. Coulter directed over 30 episodes of the hit series, including what many consider to be the best, the episode titled College from season 1 of the show. In addition, Mr. Coulter has directed episodes of the Netflix original series House of Cards, starring Kevin Spacey, and the upcoming series Ray Donovan with John Voight on Showtime. On the big screen, he's directed Ben Affleck in Hollywoodland and Robert Pattinson and Pierce Brosnan in Remember Me.
Are you in the mafia?
Am I in the what?
Whatever you want to call it. Organized crime.
That's total crap. Who told you that?
Dad, I've lived in the house all my life. I've seen police come with warrants. I've seen you going out at 3 in the morning.
So you never seen Doc Cusumano go out at 3 in the morning on a call?
Did the Cusumano kids ever find $50,000 in Krugerrands and a 45 automatic while they were hunting for Easter eggs?
I'm in a waste management business. Everybody immediately assumes you're mobbed up. It's a stereotype, and it's offensive. And you're the last person I would want to perpetuate it.
Fine.
There's no mafia.
First of all, I'm so sorry for the loss of your friend and collaborator. As a movie fan and a fan of great acting, he was special to all of us, I know.
Yeah, it's almost surprising how many people have responded and are affected by it, you know?
Yeah. I won't take up too much of your time. I just wanted to ask you a few questions about him.
Sure.
In your observation, what made his particular gifts so ideally suited to bring Tony Soprano to life?
I think the thing that occurred to me was that Jim combined some qualities that are not typical of the world of mob bosses and so on, which was a very singular kind of vulnerability, which I think Jim himself had. And obviously, which he brought to Tony Soprano. When you think about the great portrayers of tough guys, Jimmy Cagney or Humphrey Bogart, for example, come to mind, they were not notably vulnerable figures.
Mm-hmm.
the great Godfather films, that quality was not the primary quality of the tough guys in that. I mean, to a degree, of course, certainly Pacino had that. But I think that Jim combined it with, a highly sensitive kind of inner life, as well as the uncommon quality of being a sex symbol without being the typical svelte, tanned, sex god. He was definitely not that. And yet women, I know for a fact, found him alluring. And So, you know, you combine sexual magnetism with Jim's physique, with a particularly strong, sensitive inner life, and the tough guy quality. That was pretty unique in the annals of film and television.
Well, you're hearing it again and again in the tributes that are popping up, that many people felt that he was one of us. I mean, there was a very authentic, almost blue-collar quality about him. And I think that's what made his portrayal of Tony Soprano so unique as well. It wasn't limited to a tough guy.
I think you've put your finger on something that's really right. That is to say that blue collar quality, which I think Cagney had a little bit, you know, but really no one had it to the degree that Jim did, because I don't think any of the people that portrayed that were that, and I think Jim was. I mean that was his background. His understanding of that quality was very much informed, I believe, by his own life. Couple of times I saw his father, I mean, he's very much from a world that, a blue-collar world, and I think that was very, very authentic, and I think you're right. I think that it allowed every kind of person to identify with him, and, of course, you know, you can't ignore the writing, which made that possible, too.
Yeah, absolutely. We all know what an extraordinary presence he was in the finished product, but what was he like on the set?
Well, he was very, very professional. By that I mean there wasn't a lot of hanging out and having, warm and cuddly conversations. I mean, he was really interested in the work. I think that he was a very real example of what has become a cliche, but in Jim's case was true, which was that he lived the role, if not entirely off screen, certainly when he was there preparing, you know, so he would get himself in the mood for the scene, and if that meant that he was in an explosive and angry temperament because of something that had happened off camera, he would use that, or he would create that. I mean, I really do believe, I never had the chance to ask Jim about it, but I believe that he sometimes created circumstances that allowed him to feel the feelings that were appropriate for the scene, and then those would explode into the scene. So as long as you didn't take it personally, it worked. It was great. But, you know, he was a very complex man. There's no question about it.
When you think back on your time with him, do you have a most cherished memory with him?
Well, you know, that would be an odd word to use, given how... as I say, complicated Jim was, and how he could be, in an effort to get into character, you know, a prickly guy, you know, just right, you know, in the moment. But so, because he was such a professional, there wasn't a lot of personal, exchange. Curiously enough, until several years after we finished the series, and then I ran into him in the theater, and we had this very quiet and I would call it sort of intimate conversation. And then again, when I visited him after he finished a performance of Gods of Carnage in Los Angeles, I went to visit him afterwards. And it was like suddenly what had been a, you know, very professional and at times challenging relationship, suddenly all of that was in the past. And he was he was a different person. He was a very warm and charming and sweet-natured guy, which I believe lay beneath, the surface of Jim, which he drew on, but which was not exhibited much when we were doing The Sopranos. I think that part of him he kept pretty well hidden. Plus, I think Jim was very deeply conflicted about the enormous success that came on him so suddenly as a result of The Sopranos, I think.
Absolutely. And that, coupled with the difficult, oftentimes dark nature of living in that role,
yes.
I would imagine, it's quite a dynamic.
Yeah, you're right.
But Tony Soprano casts such a large shadow. It would, for any actor, the influence of that show in that particular role. How do you think he built upon that in his film career post-Sopranos, and where do you think he was yet to go?
Well, of course, it's impossible to know, but I think what Jim did, and what I think was a sign of his high intelligence, was, first of all, I think he didn't immediately start doing every mob boss available. He avoided the obvious temptation because I think he was smart enough to know that therein lay the death of his career, you know, if he had just repeated himself, because there's no question that it would have been very hard for him to have found a role of that sophistication and complexity again. So I think he was my impression was that he was very reluctant to dive back into something like that. And so I think he kind of held back. He started producing, as I'm sure you know, mm-hmm. documentaries. I think if I were to say what it struck me as was an example of someone who was smart enough to realize that he could not repeat that success in that world, and that he then started looking for other outlets, kind of stepped back in a way from that role, and took time, I think, to figure out, you know, what was next. And he became a producer. I would love to have seen what else he would have produced over time, including dramatic work, which I think he might have eventually gotten involved with. And also, I think it's a pity not to see what he would have been capable of in entirely different roles. I know, for example, that he was going to do HBO's Criminal Justice, which Richard Price was writing. And I was lucky enough to read the early scripts, and he was going to play a slovenly but extremely good and well-meaning lawyer. And I think it would have been really interesting. And I am sorry to see that he didn't get to play that role, because I think it would have been the character was a kind of good version of Tony Soprano, you know, a smart, good guy who's on the right side of the law, but who's kind of a slob. And I think it would have been really interesting to see Jim play that, and I'm sorry to see that he's not going to get to.
Yeah, me too. Mr. Coulter, my condolences to you again. And let me just tell you, I mean, I'm a huge fan of your work, and the college episode, and I know you hear this a lot, is probably the greatest hour of television I've ever seen. And I think it's the moment where you guys really found Tony Soprano and that sense of duality in that character. I think it really came to life starting in that episode. So thank you for that.
Well, thank you, and thanks for that comment. I know that David Chase actually agrees with you that for some reason that episode, as he's said on a number of occasions, told him what the show really was going to be. And it was without going off about it, you know, it was a big moment for me too, because I remember when I got the gig, and because I'd seen the pilot, which was magnificent, and I when I saw that episode, I thought, you know, I really know how to do this, and I'm glad that others agree.
All right, look, Matt, you're a grown woman, almost. Some of my money comes from illegal gambling and whatnot. How does that make you feel?
At least you don't keep denying it like Mom. Kids in school think it's actually kind of neat.
Seen The Godfather, right?
Not really. Casino we like. Sharon Stone, 70s clothes, pills.
I'm not asking about those bums. I'm asking about you.
Sometimes I wish you were like other dads. Done like Mr. Scangarello, for example. Advertising executive for big tobacco. Or lawyers? Ugh, so many dads are full of shit.
And I'm not.
Finally told the truth about this?
Continuing the celebration of Mr. Gandolfini's work, we turn to a roundtable discussion among the movie geeks, where we assess his legacy and spotlight the films and the performances that will forever live on in the wake of his passing.
You know, it's just weird. Just watched him, like, in three movies in the last, like, less than 6 months. You know, Not Fade Away, The Incredible Burt Wonderstone, and Zero Dark Thirty. And, I mean, he's getting a lot of work. And it's just like, I can't wrap my head around how young and how sudden it is.
Well, I was, I actually just went to bed and just, had a little cry about it. it's so weird, you know. I mean, with Gandolfini, you know, even though he had been in the, he had been doing movies, you know, for a little while before before he got the role with Tony Soprano, and you know, that show debuted in '99. So, but it really seems like we just didn't have a, I mean, we just didn't have enough time with him. You know, I mean,
you know,
if you think about it, he really didn't even get famous until, or come into our worldview, really, until 1999. Before then, he had had some plum roles, specifically in you know, particularly in True Romance.
Mm-hmm.
But he really wasn't on our radar, so it really felt like he was kind of just pulled from obscurity in kind of in a way when he got the Sopranos role, and so and then, you know, we were immediately clued in to just how great he really was, you know, like sort of like just this diamond that you just never noticed, you know. You know, with that show going on, you know, in shooting for, you know, almost a decade, and then now it's over, finally over, you thought, okay, well, now we're going to start seeing Gandolfini in a lot of, you know, really good roles, you know, or, and it's weird, they, you know, he's great in everything he's in, but you know, movie-wise, he just never got that really, really great role, you know. It really just feels like, something's been stolen from us.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you don't, but he did, I mean, what he got the role, I mean, let's be honest, Tony Soprano is a role of a lifetime.
Oh, yeah, no
I mean, that is the role. I mean, and the funny thing is, you can't, you know, because of his death, you really can't do, you could never now do a movie or anything. You couldn't do any further kind of exploration. Because Tony Soprano, you have nothing. Without Gandolfini, you don't, I mean, that's not to take credit away from everyone else, but he was the power behind the show, his character. And there's no one who can really play that part. He was sort of born to play that part.
Well, it's not even a question. I mean, they just that would. I don't know what was in David Chase's mind, whether he was, you know, cooking up something or anything like
he
that.
He might have
but,
been.
You know,
I mean,
it's definitely.
But
it's definitely
dead
off the board
now. It's gone. You can't do anything with it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think a Sopranos movie would have happened no matter what. But
yeah,
with the Sopranos, he was able to create this character over a period of many years that David Chase wrote in a very complicated fashion. I mean, mm-hmm. there's a very stereotypical way to play somebody connected, somebody involved in organized crime, and he brought that toughness to it and that imposing weight he had to it. But at the same time, when you saw Gandolfini, and I think this is what made Tony Soprano work so well, when you saw him in pretty much any performance, you knew that he was one of us.
Mm-hmm.
There was such a kind of working-class, blue-collar quality
right.
about him.
Which is,
relatable.
Which is what he was. I mean, he was a bartender and a nightclub guy, you know, for years before he really burst onto the scene.
Right.
So, I mean, so he really was, in a lot of ways, very working class. And, you know, I mean, he remained pretty shy, too, you know. I mean, he's not somebody who really I mean, he was always kind to reporters, I think, but I don't think he really liked the spotlight on him
mm-hmm.
very much. And in 2002, I happened to be in New York and staying close to Little Italy and went around the corner and saw that there was a film company shooting. I thought, oh, my God, what could this be? I thought, it can't be what I think it might be, could it? And indeed was. It was, you know, I turned around the corner and saw Gandolfini and Frank Vincent and Vincent Curatello. I think that's the guy's name who played Johnny Sack. And I said, oh, my God, they're shooting The Sopranos there. And I only sat there for about 5 minutes, and then they called it a wrap, you know. And he started gathering up and getting ready to leave, you know. So for him, leaving was just walking down the street. I suppose, you know, he was living in the village, I think. And
right.
So for him, it was just a walk home for him. And suddenly, you know, he was surrounded by fans, and he was stopping, taking photos with fans. And he stopped to pet a dog and talked to a local business owner there and stuff like that. I shook his hand. He had just negotiated for a higher salary. So I guess he was getting like $1 million an episode or something like that. And I went up and shook his hand. He's got a big, I mean, he's a big guy. Not just big in the tummy, but big guy. So I shook his hand and said, Mr. Gandolfini, you did a good job in renegotiating that thing because you deserve it. You're the best thing on TV. He said, thank you very much.
He's got one more movie that's left to come out. It's called Animal Rescue. It's based on a Dennis Lehane screenplay.
Mm-hmm.
It's got Thomas Hardy in it. And then he did a pilot that he sold to HBO to make into a series. So I don't know if we'll ever see that pilot.
Mm-hmm.
He's also got one more thing. That's Nicole Hollis movie.
Yeah, that hasn't come out yet. But The Animal Rescue is his last film. Like, it's the last film he shot.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But you're absolutely right. There's that other movie. What's the title of it?
It's just untitled Nicole.
It's untitled right now. It's got Catherine Keener as usual with her, mm-hmm. and also who's Elaine on The Sopranos on Seinfeld.
Right.
What's her name?
Julia
Louis-Dreyfus is in it as well. So we've still got a couple more things, but. I read about that HBO series, and I was excited about that.
And the last movie that he did that came out in theaters was Burt Wonderstone. While I don't think that's a very good movie,
no.
I thought he was good in it. I liked seeing him in a comedy.
It's just good to see him. I mean, we like to see him. Yeah. And I mean, I wouldn't, you know, he was really great as the father and not Fade Away.
He really was
with Zero Dark Thirty, I thought the scenes that he's in are actually, some of the most powerful scenes in the whole movie, or at least.
And it is a jolt, because when I first saw Zero Dark Thirty, I had no idea he was in it.
Yeah.
So it is a jolt when he first comes on screen, because you've been watching the movie for about a good hour and a half or whatever it was, and then Gandolfini pops up and you're like, oh gosh, he's in this. That's so wonderful.
Yeah.
You know, he was always a welcome presence.
Isn't he pathetic in a pathetic quality in Killing Them Softly? You know, his character in that is, because you're watching, you know, you were so used to watching Tony Soprano, and then you see this really pathetic, aging hitman in Killing Them Softly, and let's not forget something like Where the Wild Things Are, where he's so sweet.
Yeah.
And innocent, mm-hmm. really, in that,
David Chase made mention of his sad eyes that made him one of the great actors.
Yeah. Which he really uses his eyes really well as Tony Soprano. I mean, that's his biggest feature in a lot of ways is,
right.
You know, he could let you know what the character was thinking without saying a word.
Mm-hmm.
Just a shift of his eyes moving from one place to another place.
I remember, I mean, like Dean said, we all remember probably the first time that we really noticed him being True Romance. But I also really liked him in a film that came out not very long after that, which was Night Falls in Manhattan.
Yeah.
Sidney Lumet movie. And again, another role and movie that depended upon his, that called upon his special quality that he is just a guy in your neighborhood, you know,
right.
Like a neighborhood guy.
Yeah.
I mean, authentic he was. And then Rod Laurie gave him a chance to play something quite different in The Last Castle, where he played opposite his one of his icons, Robert Redford, as this kind of really buttoned up, straight laced military man. That was a very different change of pace for
him.
When you first arrived here, I asked you a question. Apparently, I need to ask it again. What do you want from your time here at the castle, Mr. Irwin?
And my answer is the same as it was then. Do my time, go home.
So you say, but everything you have done has contradicted that. These men are not here for unpaid parking fines and traffic.
I'm under no illusion why the men are here, Colonel. I just think they might be reminded about some of the good things they have done, rather than only the worst.
Yes, that is something my predecessor used to say. In his last 2 years here, there were 7 escape attempts, 12 injury assaults on officers and NCOs, including one killed. Since I've assumed command, there have been 0 escape attempts, 0 injury assaults, 0 fatalities. Some may question my methods, but they do work. No soldier has ever died needlessly under my command, Mr. Irwin. See, I too share the burden of command. You may not think that I have ever set foot on a battlefield, but that's because you have never sat behind this desk. This desk. My men and I are vastly outnumbered. We spend every day behind enemy lines. Because make no mistake about it, Mr. Irwin, they are the enemy. But I don't need to justify myself to you, do I?
I don't know. Do you?
I always remember him, too, in a movie that I didn't really care for. He was the best thing about it, was The Mexican.
Yeah.
With Brad Pitt, where he was playing the gay hitman.
Yeah.
Which was a very, very unusual role, and maybe one of my favorite film performances by him.
Yeah. He was. He helped that out a lot.
Yeah. I mean, he was the one thing about that particular film, even though it had Brad Pitt and Julia Roberts in it, that was incredibly memorable.
Well, here's the thing about me. I'm a product of my emotions versus being a product of my environment, like him, which he is exactly, just that environmental. I need sunshine to grow. That's who I am. And with the projection of it, I have goals.
That's your answer?
Yeah.
That's not right. I mean, there's a right answer here, but that's not it. Look, in my business, you're surrounded by loneliness and finality. Now, I don't care what you take is on an afterlife. When people die, it's scary. And they go alone. Now, the people that I send off that have experienced love, they're a little less scared. I mean, they're still scared, but there's a calmness to them. And I think that comes from the knowledge that somebody somewhere loved them and cared for them and will miss them. Now, I see that from time to time, and I am awed by it. I don't think I'd be telling you any of this if it wasn't for Frank. Anyway, it's a loaded question. Look, when two people love each other, totally, truthfully, all the way, love each other, the answer to that question is simple, especially in your case. When do you get to that point where enough is enough? Never.
I also, you know, went back not too long ago and checked out William Friedkin's version of 12 Angry Men, and he's jury number 6 in that. That's a pretty incredible cast, and not a bad remake either. I mean, a very, very respectable remake of something with something that's, you know, of a work that, you know, the original film version, if not the original TV version, has become, you know, incredibly
Friedkin wrote about him in his Friedkin wrote about Gandolfini in his new autobiography, and he said while they were shooting 12 Angry Men, Gandolfini was like off in the corner, he was pacing, and he was really, really nervous. And Friedkin said, "What's wrong?" And he said, "I'm just so nervous. I'm working with Jack Lemmon." And he said, "Do you think I'm doing okay?" And Friedkin says, "Yeah, you're going to be a major star, and people eventually one day will say that about you, that they can't believe they're working with you." And Friedkin says in the book that, you know, he didn't know if he was right or not. But then The Sopranos hit, and he knew that, you know, that was a reality for Gandolfini. He was on, he was always a great working character actor, but The Sopranos put him on the other side.
Right.
And I don't think he felt entirely comfortable with that, because he was so incredibly shy. But obviously it led to great opportunity. But even before The Sopranos, he was working with terrific filmmakers. Tony Scott he worked with many times. And, of course, as we mentioned, Lubat and Friedkin. So he
did Crimson Tide. He was in Crimson Tide, yeah. Remember? That was a big deal. And I'm glad you brought up Night Falls on Manhattan because it's such an underrated movie. And he was
okay, we have a phone call. 515 area code. I'm going to pick it up now. Hi, 515 area code.
Hello.
Hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Hey. Not bad.
I just wanted to quick point out that he was great in True Romance by Tony Scott. I love that movie, and I thought he was really great in it. And I thought he was actually pretty scary. I saw it when I was pretty young. I shouldn't have been watching it, but he terrified me actually in it.
Yeah, it's a terrifying scene an impossible scene as well. And he talked about many times the difficulty he had with that because not only is it extremely violent, but it's violence against women, and that was something he was really like uncomfortable portraying.
Yeah,
but he went all the way with it. There's only one way to do that.
My favorite moment in that scene, though, is where the violence stops, and he actually stops and says, "You know, you're a really great girl," and everything. He says that. He kind of breaks that tension and says, "Well, I have a lot of respect for you. You're really fighting." You know?
I think he kind of like stood there, and I think he really did for a moment, just be like, "Wow, this girl is great, but I'm going to do this anyway." And it gave me the chills. I don't know.
Well, yeah. I really appreciate you calling in and sharing your thoughts, and thank you so much for it.
Oh, no problem.
Thanks. Yeah, thank you.
All right, my friend. Bye bye.
What you really see in that scene is really just sort of the weird combination that you would see a lot of in The Sopranos of being like a killer and also being somebody with a really big heart. So you get both of those things.
Well, that was the great paradox, or I guess the great conflict for him, was he has these two families and doesn't really ever, you never get the feeling he never knows how to really reconcile. He never really knows how to reconcile either one of them. I mean, well, actually going to a shrink, which was probably one of the greatest touches on that show, and also one of the greatest relationships was his relationship with Lorraine Bracco. That was a fascinating dynamic, and kudos to both of them for being able to pull that off. And you never knew where that was going to go in some episodes. And this is, you know, you're always hoping to one employee, the episode against Employee of the Month, where she's raped, right? She's raped. You're always hoping that there would be a follow up that he would go, because but they never did that, though. Or maybe he might have done it, but he's never talked about. But he had a very, as the thing went on, as much as they would fight and everything, I think that was really might be the great relationship in the show.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's definitely the relationship that sort of defines the show in a lot of ways, because really the show is really about a guy who's going to get help, but does not realize it yet that he's not going to be able to get the help that he wants because he can't tell the truth about himself.
Right.
And if he can't tell the truth about himself to his therapist, then he's not really going to get any further than he is right now. Right then, I mean, the entire show is really about lying. That's I mean, it's not just about Tony Sprinter lying to his therapist, but it's there's just you know, a series of lies that go back and forth between, you know, he and Chris and I mean, everybody in that show is lying either to themselves or to other people or being people that they really aren't in order to get further up the ladder or to get more money or whatever, you know. And then you get into the guy that comes out of the closet and has to go on the lam. That huge lie. I mean, the whole show is about
that's
the through line that's running through it. Yeah. You know, I saw James Gandolfini one more time. I should say this on the show. I saw him one more time. I had just come out of going to see Anne Hathaway in Twelfth Night in the park, and I just found myself in the Village for some reason, and heading home, and it was a big rainstorm, and there I was on Sixth Avenue or whatever, and I looked behind me and saw Gandolfini hailing down a cab for a bunch of old ladies who were weighed down with all these bags and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess they couldn't get a cab, but once Gandolfini steps out and hails the cab,
you know,
a cab is going to stop. And sure enough, a cab stopped, and they got in, and he stopped to take a picture with them and everything. And I just stood there and looked, you know, and I thought about going up to him, but I said, no, I know that he doesn't want to be bothered, so I didn't. But I just saw him get the cab and take some pictures with people and then cross the street and then, I guess, back home for him, you know. But I thought, wow, what a great guy.
So do you have a favorite episode with Gandolfini in Sopranos?
The one I really like is, I think it's the second to last or the last one of the first season, where he gets even, you know, people are trying to get him, and he gets even with a lot of people. I love that one. There's another one, the Employee of the Month one I liked a lot, too. But I think the best one, I think you brought this up, is the one where he takes Meadow for the college. And that is the best. I mean, that is the shining example. I mean, that really is the best episode, the duality and everything in that episode. The lying, as you say, Dean, is on full display brilliantly in that episode.
You know, there's also, those scenes with Lorraine Bracco really allowed him to play every single color imaginable.
Mm-hmm.
And so some of the best moments are the quietest moments, the moments when he realizes the legacy that that he's leaving his children. I mean,
mm-hmm.
both the hopes he has for his children and the sadness about the position that he's put them in, particularly his son.
Oh, yeah, and that's
who suffers from the same affliction as he does with the panic attack.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that scene, was it the one where he, you know, he's making fun of AJ for being fat and everything, and then at the end of that episode, remember, he shares a pizza with him?
Yeah.
And I know, I thought that was a really nice touch.
One of my favorite episodes is from 2004. It's called Irregular Around the Margins.
Mm-hmm.
And it begins with Tony finding out that he has cancer, or small cancer on his forehead, And then he starts hanging around Adriana's club a lot.
Right.
And he comes this close to making out with Adriana, and then they get in the car accident, and he has to deal with the aftermath with Chris finding out and
right.
Chris suspecting that something was up, and he has to lie his way out of it, really.
Right.
There's just all sorts of crazy lies going on in that show, you
yeah.
know?
You know, also, not to be overlooked, is the work he did for veterans. He did HBO documentaries on veterans of various wars, including the most recent conflicts. And so he obviously had a very soft spot in his heart for them.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the one, I did watch one of them, I think he made two of them, and I did watch one of them, and he was off camera asking questions. I mean, he was part of the documentary, and you saw the way he related to them. And how giving and understanding and compassionate he was of them and that. If you were to recommend a couple of essential Gandolfini performances, which ones would they be for our listeners?
I guess I've already said a few of them. I mean, definitely. I'm just keeping myself to the movies now because, you know, of course, Tony Soprano, obviously, but the Mexican, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
True Romance.
Definitely True Romance. In the Loop.
Maybe In the Loop, yeah.
Yeah, I would definitely put In the Loop in there, and mm-hmm. I would have to put Where the Wild Things Are, and I would put The Man Who Wasn't There.
Yeah.
As well as Night Falls on Manhattan.
And even Welcome to the Rileys, you
yes,
know,
yeah,
that was good too.
A singer in a snow cave.